Jeff Briggs' Love Story, Part 1 by Bret Hart. It was raining and blowing at Eldridge's Crossing. From the stately pine trees on the hilltops, which were dignifiedly protesting through their rigid spines upward to the hysterical willows in the hollow that had whipped themselves into a maudlin fury, there was a general tumult. When the wind lulled, the rain kept up the distraction, firing long volleys across the road, letting loose miniature cataracts from the hillsides to brawl in the ditches, and beating down the heavy heads of wild oats on the levels. When the rain ceased for a moment, the wind charged over the already defeated field, ruffled the gullies, scattered the spray from the roadside pines, and added insult to injury. But both wind and rain concentrated their energies in a malevolent attempt to utterly disperse and scatter the halfway house, which seemed to have wholly lost its way, and strayed into the open, where, dazed and bewildered, unprepared and unprotected, it was exposed to the taunting fury of the blast. A loose, shambling, disjointed, hastily built structure, representing the worst features of pioneer Renaissance, it rattled its loose window sashes like chattering teeth, banged its ill-hung shutters, and admitted so much of the invading storm that it might have blown up or blown down with equal facility. Jefferson Briggs, proprietor and landlord of the halfway house, had just gone through the formality of closing his house for the night, hanging dangerously out of the window in the vain attempt to subdue a rebellious shutter that had evidently entered into conspiracy with the invaders, and shutting a door as against a sheriff's posse, was going to bed, that is, to read himself to sleep, as was his custom. As he entered his little bedroom in the attic, with a highly exciting novel in his pocket and a kerosene lamp in his hand, the wind, lying in wait for him, instantly extinguished his lamp and slammed the door behind him. Jefferson Briggs relighted the lamp, as if confidentially, in the corner, and shielding it in the bosom of his red flannel shirt, which gave him the appearance of an illuminated shrine, hung a heavy bearskin across the window, and then carefully deposited his lamp upon a chair at his bedside. This done, he kicked off his boots, flung them into a corner, and rolling himself in a blanket, lay down upon the bed. A habit of early rising, bringing with it, presumably, the proverbial accompaniment of health, wisdom, and pecuniary emoluments, had also brought with it a certain idea of the effeminacy of separate toilettes and the virtue of readiness. In a few moments he was deep in a chapter. A vague pecking at his door, as of an unseasonable woodpecker, finally asserted itself to his consciousness. "Come in," he said, with his eyes still on the page. The door opened to a gaunt figure, partly composed of bed quilts and partly of plaid shawl, a predominance of the latter, and a long wisp of iron-gray hair determined her sex. She leaned against the post with an air of fatigue, half moral and half physical. "How can ye lie there abed, Jeff, and read and smoke on sich a night? The Spirit of the Lord abroad over the earth, and upstage not gone by it. Well, well, it's well at ease. Some ease can sleep." The up coach, like as not, is stopped by the high water on the North Fork 10 miles away, Auntie, responded Jeff, keeping to the facts, possibly not recognizing the hand of the beneficent Creator in the rebellious window shutter. He avoided theology. "Well," responded the figure, with an air of delivering an unheeded and thankless warning, "it is not for me to say. Perhaps it's all his wisdom that some will keep to their own mind. It's well as some hasn't nerves and can luxuriate in tobacco in the night watches. But he says I'll come like a thief in the night. Like a thief in the night, Jeff." Totally unable to reconcile this illustration with the delayed pioneer coach and Yuba Bill, its driver, Jeff lay silent. In his own way, perhaps he was uneasy, not to say shocked, at his aunt's habitual freedom of scriptural quotation, as that good lady herself was, with an occasional oath from his lips, a fact, by the way, not generally understood by purveyors of scripture, licensed and unlicensed. "I'd take a pull at them bitters, Auntie," said Jeff feebly, with his wandering eye still recurring to his page. "They'll do ye a power of good in the way of calming your nerves. If I was like some folks, I wouldn't want bitters, though made out of the simplest yarbs of the earth, with just enough spirit to bring out the virtues, as Deacon Store's balm or Gilead is what you're meanin'. If I was like some folks, I would lie there and smoke in the lap of idleness with 14 beds in the house empty and nary lodger for one of them. If I was that indifferent to having invested my fortune in the goodwill of this house, and not as much as a single transient looking in, I could lie down and take comfort in profane literature, but it ain't in me to do it. And it wasn't your father's way, Jeff, neither." As the elder Briggs' way had been to seek surcease from such trouble at the gambling table, and eventually in suicide, Jeff could not deny it. But he did not say that a full realization of his unhappy venture overcame him as he closed the blinds of the hotel that night, and that the half-desperate idea of abandoning it there and then to the warring elements that had resented his trespass on nature seemed to him an act of simple reason and justice. He did not say this, for easy-going natures are not apt to explain the processes by which their content or resignation is reached, and are therefore supposed to have none. Keeping to the facts, he simply suggested the weather was unfavorable to travelers, and again found his place on the page before him. Fixing it with his thumb, he looked up resignedly. The figure wearily detached itself from the doorpost, and Jeff's eyes fell on his book. "You won't stop, Auntie?" he asked mechanically, as if reading aloud from the page. But she was gone. A little ashamed, although much relieved, Jeff fell back again to literature, interrupted only by the charging of the wind and the heavy volley of rain. Presently he found himself wondering if a certain banging were really a shutter, and then, having settled it in his mind that it was, he was startled by a shout. Another, and in the road before the house. Jeff put down the book and marked the place by turning down the leaf, being one of that large class of readers whose mental facilities are butter-fingered and easily slip their hold. Then he resumed his boots and was duly caparisoned. He extinguished the kerosene lamp and braved the outer air and strong currents of the hall and stairway in the darkness. Lighting two candles in the bar room, he proceeded to unlock the hall door. At the same instant, a furious blast shook the house. The door yielded slightly and impelled a thin, meek-looking stranger violently against Jeff, who still struggled with it. "An accident has occurred," began the stranger, but here the wind charged again, blew open the door, pinned Jeff behind it back against the wall, overturned the dripping stranger, dashed up the staircase and slammed every door in the house, ending triumphantly with number 14 and a crash of glass in the window. "Come, rouse up," said Jeff, still struggling with the door. "Rouse up and lend a hand here." Thus abjured, the stranger crept along the wall toward Jeff and began again. "We've met with an accident." But here another and mightier gust left him speechless, covered him with a spray of a wildly disorganized water spout that, dangling from the roof, seemed to be playing on the front door, drove him into the black obscurity, and again sandwiched his host between the door and the wall. Then there was a lull, and in the midst of it, Yuba Bill, driver of the Pioneer coach, quietly and coolly, impervious and waterproof, walked into the hall, entered the bar room, took a candle, and going behind the bar, selected a bottle, critically examined it, and returning, poured out a quantity of whiskey in a glass and gulped it in a single draught. All this while Jeff was closing the door, and the meek-looking man was coming into the light again. Yubaville squared his shoulders behind him and rested them on the bar, crossed his legs easily and awaited them. In reply to Jeff's inquiring but respectful look, he said shortly, "Oh, you're there, are you?" "Yes, Bill." "Well, this here newfangled root of yours is 10 feet deep in a holler with backwater from the North Fork. I've taken that year coach into 4 feet of it, and I reckon I couldn't have any more. I'll stand on this year hand," says I. "I brought the horses up here and landed them in your barn to eat their blessed heads off until the water goes down. That's what's the matter, old man, and just about what I calculated on from those derned old improvements of yours." Coloring a little on this new count in the general indictment against the uselessness of the halfway house, Jeff asked if there were any passengers. Yuba Bill indicated the meek stranger with a jerk of his thumb. "And his wife and a daughter is in the coach. They're all right and tight as if they was in a Fifth Avenue hotel. But I reckon he allows to fetch him up here," added Bill, as if he strongly doubted the wisdom of the transfer. The meek man, much meeker for the presence of Bill, here suggested that such indeed was his wish, and further prayed that Jeff would accompany him to the coach to assist in bringing them up. "It's rather wet and dark," said the man apologetically. "My daughter is not strong. Have you such a thing as a waterproof?" Jeff had not, but would a bearskin do? It would. Jeff ran, tore down his extempore window curtain, and returned with it. Yuba Bill, who had quietly and disapprovingly surveyed the proceeding, here disengaged himself from the bar with evident reluctance. "He'll want another man," he said to Jeff, "unless you can carry double. As he," indicating the stranger, "is no sort of use, he'd better stay here in 10 bar, while you and me fetch the women off. "'Specially as I reckon we've got to do some tall wading by this time to reach him." The meek man sat down helplessly in a chair indicated by Bill, who at once strode after Jeff. In another moment they were both fighting their way step by step against the storm in that peculiar drunken spasmodic way so amusing to the spectator and so exasperating to the performer. It was no time for conversation. Even interjectional profanity was dangerously exhaustive. The coach was scarcely 1,000 yards away, but its bright lights were reflected in a sheet of dark, silent water that stretched between it and the two men. Wading and splashing, they soon reached it, and a gully where the surplus water was pouring into the valley below. 4 feet of water around her, but can't get any higher. So you see she's all right for a month of such weather." Inwardly admiring the perspicacity of his companion, Jeff was about to open the coach door when Bill interrupted. "I'll pack the old woman if you'll look arter the daughter and any little traps." A female face, anxious and elderly, here appeared at the window. "That's my little game," said Bill, sotto voce. "Is there any danger?" "Where's my husband?" asked the woman impatiently. "As to danger, ma'am, there ain't any. You're as safe here as you'd be in a Sacramento steamer. As to your husband, he allowed I was to come here and fetch her up to the hotel. That's his lookout." With this cheerful speech, Bill proceeded to make 2 or 3 ineffectual scoops into the dark interior, manifestly with the idea of scooping out the lady in question. In another instant he had caught her, lifted her gently but firmly in his arms, and was turning away. "But my child, my daughter, she's asleep," expostulated the woman. But Bill was already swiftly splashing through the darkness. Jeff, left to himself, hastily examined the coach. On the back seat, a slight, small figure enveloped in a shawl lay motionless. Jeff threw the bearskin over it gently, lifted it on one arm, and gathering a few traveling bags and baskets with the other, prepared to follow his quickly disappearing leader. A few feet from the coach, the water appeared to deepen and the bear skin to draggle. Jeff drew the figure up higher in vain. "Sis," he said softly. No reply. "Sis," shaking her gently. There was a slight movement within the wrappings. "Couldn't you climb up on my shoulder, honey? That's a good child." There were one or two spasmodic jerks of the bear skin, and, aided by Jeff, the bundle was presently seated on his shoulder. "Are you all right for now, sis?" Something like a laugh came from the bear skin. Then a childish voice said, "Thank you, I think I am." "Aren't you afraid you'll fall off?" "A little." Jeff hesitated. It was beginning to blow again. "You couldn't reach down and put your arm around my neck, could you, honey?" "I'm afraid not, although there was a slight attempt to do so." "No? No." "Well, then, take a good holt, a firm, strong holt of my hair. Don't be afraid." A small hand timidly began to rummage in Jeff's thick curls. "Take a firm holt. There, just back of my neck. That's right." The little hand closed over half a dozen curls. The little figure shook and giggled. "Now, don't you see, honey, if I'm careless with you and don't keep you plump level up there, you just give me a pull and fetch me up all standing." "I see." "Of course you do. That's because you're a little lady." Jeff strode on. It was pleasant to feel the soft, warm fingers in his hair, pleasant to hear the faint, childish voice, pleasant to draw the feet of the enwrapped figure against his broad breast. Altogether, he was sorry when they reached the dry land and the lee of the halfway house, where a slight movement of the figure expressed a wish to dismount. "Not yet, Missy," said Jeff, "not yet. You'll get blown away, sure. And then what'll they say?" "No, honey, I'll take you right into your papa, just as you are." A few steps more, Jeff strode into the hall, made his way to the sitting room, walked to the sofa, and deposited his burden. The bearskin fell back, the shawl fell back, and Jeff fell back too, for before him lay a small, slight, but beautiful and perfectly formed woman. He had time to see that the meek man, no longer meek, but apparently a stern, uncompromising parent, was standing at the head of the sofa, that the elderly and nervous female was hovering at the foot, that his aunt, with every symptom of religious and moral disapproval of his conduct, sat rigidly in one of the rigid chairs. He had time to see all this before the quick, hot blood flying to his face sent the water into his eyes and he could see nothing. The cause of all this smiled, a dazzling smile, though a faint one, that momentarily lit up the austere gloom of the room and its occupants. "You must thank this gentleman, Papa," said she, languidly turning to her father, "for his kindness and his trouble. He's carried me here as gently and as carefully as if I were a child." Seeing symptoms of a return of Jeff's distress in his coloring face, she added softly, as if to herself, "It's a great thing to be strong, a greater thing to be strong and gentle." The voice thrilled through Jeff, but into this dangerous human voice twanged the accents of special spiritual revelation and called him to himself again. "Be ye wise as serpents, but harmless as doves," said Jeff's aunt generally, "and let em be thankful as doesn't abuse the strength the Lord gives em, but be allers ready to answer for it at the bar of their Maker." Possibly some suggestion in her figure of speech reminded her of Jeff's forgotten duties, so she added in the same breath and tone, "Especially when transient customers is waitin' for their liquor, and Yuba Bill hammerin' on the counter with his glass, and yere ye stand, Jeff, never even takin' up that wet bearskin enough to give that young woman her death." Stammering out an incoherent apology addressed vaguely to the occupants of the room, but looking toward the languid goddess on the sofa, Jeff seized the bearskin and backed out the door. Then he flew to his room with it, and then returned to the barroom, but the impatient William of Yuba had characteristically helped himself and gone off to the stable. Then Jeff stole into the hall and halted before the closed door of the sitting room. A bold idea of going in again as became a landlord of the halfway house with an inquiry if they wished anything further had seized him, but the remembrance that he had always meekly allowed that duty to devolve upon his aunt, and that she would probably resent it with scriptural authority and bring him to shame again, stayed his timid knuckles at the door. In this hesitation he stumbled upon his aunt coming down the stairs with an armful of blankets and pillows, attended by their small Indian servant, staggering under a mattress. "Is everything all right, Auntie?"
"Ye can be thankful to the Lord, Jeff Briggs, that this didn't happen last week when I was down on my back with rheumatiz, but you're never grateful."
"The young lady, is she comfortable?" said Jeff, accepting his aunt's previous remark as confirmatory.
"As well as any creature marked by the finger of the Lord with galloping consumption can be, I reckon. And she, as oughter be putting off earthly vanities, asking for a looking-glass. And you traipsing through the hall with her on your shoulder, and dancing and jouncing her up and down as if it was a ballroom."
A guilty recollection that he had skipped with her through the passage struck him with remorse as his aunt went on.
"It's a mercy that betwixt you and the wet bar skin she ain't got her death."
"Don't you think, Auntie," stammered Jeff, "that my being the landlord, you know, it would be the square thing, just out of respect, you know, for me to drop in there and ask them there's anything they wanted?" His aunt stopped and resignedly put down the pillows. "Sarah," she said meekly to the handmaiden, "you can leave go of that mattress.
Here's Mr. Jefferson thinks we ain't good enough to make the beds for them two city women folks, and he allows he'll do it himself."
"Well, no, Auntie," began the horrified Jeff, but failing to placate his injured relative, took safety in flight. Once safe in his own room, his eye fell on the bearskin. It certainly was wet. Perhaps he'd been careless. Perhaps he had imperiled her life. His cheeks flushed as he threw it hastily in the corner. Something fell from it on the floor. Jeff picked it up and held it to the light. It was a small, very small lady's slipper. Holding it within the palm of his hand as if it had been some delicate flower which the pressure of a finger might crush, he strode to the door but stopped. Should he give it to his aunt? Even if she overlooked this evident proof of his carelessness, what would she think of the young ladies? Ought he, seductive thought, go downstairs again, knock at the door, and give it to its fair owner, with the apology he was longing to make? Then he remembered that he had but a few moments before been dismissed from the room, very much as if he were the original proprietor of the skin he had taken. Perhaps they were right, perhaps he was only a foolish, clumsy animal. Yet she had thanked him, and had said in the sweet childlike voice, "It is such a great thing to be strong, a greater thing to be strong and gentle." He was strong. Strong men had said so. He did not know if he was gentle, too. Had she meant that when she turned her strangely soft dark eyes upon him? For some moments he held the slipper hesitatingly in his hand. Then as he opened his trunk and disposing various articles around it as if it were some fragile, perishable object, laid it carefully therein. This done, he drew off his boots and, rolling himself in his blanket, lay down upon the bed. He did not open his novel. He did not follow up the exciting love episode of his favorite hero. So ungrateful is humanity to us poor romancers in the first stages of their real passion. Ah, me! 'Tis the jongleurs and troubadours they want, not us. When Master Slender, sick for Sweet Anne Page, would, rather than 40 shillings, he had his book of songs and sonnets there, what availed it that the Italian Boccaccio had contemporaneously discoursed wisely and sweetly of love and prose? I doubt not that Master Jeff would have mumbled some verse to himself had he known any. Knowing none, he lay there and listened to the wind. Did she hear it? Did it keep her awake? He had an uneasy suspicion that the shutter that was banging so outrageously was the shutter of her room. Filled with this miserable thought, he arose softly, stole down the staircase, and listened.
The sound was repeated. It was truly the refractory shutter of number 7, the best bedroom adjoining the sitting room. The next room, number 8, was vacant. Jeff entered it softly as softly opened the window, and leaning far out in the tempest, essayed to secure the nocturnal disturber, but in vain. Cord or rope had he none, nor could he procure either without alarming his aunt, an extremity not to be considered. Jeff was a man of clumsy but forceful expedients. He hung far out of the window, and with one powerful hand lifted the shutter off its hinges and dragged it softly into number 8. Then, as softly, he crept upstairs to bed. The wind howled and tore round the house. The crazy water pipe below Jeff's window creaked, the chimneys whistled, but the shutter banged no more. Jeff began to doze. "It's a great thing to be strong," the wind seemed to say as it charged upon the defenseless house. And then another voice seemed to reply, "A greater thing to be strong and gentle," and hearing this, he fell asleep.